You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 298 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode with Adam Isaacson of WOLA. I found it to be very entertaining and informative to have Adam here talking to us about what's going on in Colombia and the region and the work of the Washington office on Latin America. So if you haven't already tuned into that, please do so. Still remaining popular in this period of time is the episode some weeks ago with Hernando Echeverri about indigenous medicines from the Amazon. So focusing on yahe and other medicines from the Amazon being used to treat trauma in areas which have been afflicted by natural disasters. So very, very interesting episode there too. But yes, this week, episode 298, we follow the line and get another journalist, another foreign correspondent on, because I find, having been a foreign correspondent myself for so long, it's so fascinating to hear of people, you know, chasing the stories and telling maybe the less said, the less told stories, the less known stories from this region. So we've got Dylan Badur, who's originally from Austin, Texas. He'll be talking about some of the stories that he's been working on, perhaps most interestingly, about ex-FARC or former FARC combatants trying to make it out there alone in their own style of reintegration back into society. So very interesting, and you should stay tuned up until segment three of the show to be able to hear about this with him. But I'll leave you in the capable hands of Adrian Alsimer, who will be giving you this week's news update for episode 298 from his nest in Medellin, Antioquia, and of course he's the director of Columbia Reports, and Columbia Reports is reader funded, so please throw some dollars at Columbia Reports if you have a spare few around, because we need to ensure that the independent media continues to keep telling the news about Colombia and what's going on. And Adrian, of course, is committed to this and committed to ensuring that the news gets out there beyond the mainstream media. So that's me signing off for this segment one of the Columbia Calling podcast, episode 298. And then it will be Adrian Alsimer talking about the news. And then it will be us back with Dylan Badur on the line from downtown Bogota, but telling us about some of his adventures in Colombia. So don't go away. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
My name is Adrian Alsman. This is news for Colombia Calling for November 5, 2019. President Ivan Duque announced he would send 2,500 troops to the southwestern Cauca province after the latest killing of an indigenous governor. The announcement followed more than a year of government inaction against what native Colombian authorities call a genocide. The president continues to refuse to talk to the indigenous authorities who demand his government implement a 2016 peace deal with demobilized FARC guerrillas. In response to the latest escalation of violence, indigenous organizations announced they would join a national strike on November 21. This anti-government protest was already being organized by labor unions and social organizations, but could become huge now that native Colombians are joining. Students have been holding marches for over a month already, and also the country's peace movement announced a protest later this month. The devastating defeat of the president's far-right Democratic Center Party in local elections last week triggered infighting. Some senators have openly blamed Duque for the defeat, and others blamed the defeat in Medellin on far-right Senator Paola Holguin. Party leader and former president Alvaro Uribe was forced to step in publicly to urge unity. Journalist Daniel Coronel reported that Uribe admitted to the Supreme Court that he was aware he used fabricated evidence in court. According to court transcripts obtained by Coronel, Uribe's fixer Diego Cadena personally wrote witness testimonies on blank papers signed by paramilitaries. If Uribe is convicted of the fraud and bribery charges filed by the court, he could face a prison sentence of 6 to 8 years. Former President Juan Manuel Santos has refused to appear before the National Electoral Council for a hearing on the Odebrecht bribery scandal. The CNE wants to interrogate the former president about his alleged knowledge of illegal payments made to his 2014 campaign. According to Santos, the CNE cannot prosecute him because he was enjoying presidential immunity at the time. Homicides in Colombia are on the increase for the second year in a row after hitting an all-time low in 2017. According to preliminary figures of the Medical Examiner's Office, the number of homicides increased more than 2.1% in the first 9 months of the year. The deadly violence escalated slightly in the third quarter when authorities registered a 4.2% increase. That's the end of this week's news bulletin. Now back to Colombia Calling with Richard McCall.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. My very special guest on this episode 298 of the Colombia Calling podcast is Dylan Badur. He's a freelance journalist from Texas in the USA. He's worked for the Houston Chronicle. He's been down here for a couple of years. His bylines appear in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and other great publications out there. And the reason we've got him on is because basically, you know, Latin America has been up in flames the last few weeks. And let's talk a little bit about some of the goings on down here in Colombia, too. So, Dylan, thank you for agreeing to be on Colombia Calling.
Sure thing, Richard. My pleasure. It's a great podcast.
Thank you very much. Flattery, as always, will get you everywhere. But and so, Dylan, what, I mean, you know, you had, a steady job at the Houston Chronicle, and you said, well, that's it. I'm going to head on down to Colombia.
Yeah, just about. I always had the goal of going into, I don't know, foreign correspondence or just working in journalism, you know, outside of the country. So I did that at the Houston Chronicle for a while and saved up some money. And I told everybody I was going to the Philippines, and I had some people there who suggested that I should go to Venezuela instead. But they never gave me a visa. So I thought I could come to Colombia and get a visa and get in. And that also didn't work. So then I just stayed in Bogota, and I've been here 2 years.
Cool. But have you actually sort of ventured across the border into Venezuela then to do some reporting?
I haven't, because I think there's a lot of hazard being picked up by the guard. You know, Venezuelan citizens get pretty rough treatment by their own, like, National Guard. And an American there without a visa, especially, like, doing journalism, I think would be a big problem.
Yes. No, I think that's absolutely, definitely an issue that could come up and get you in a lot of trouble. But you've done a lot of reporting from within the Colombian side of the border.
Sure. I started most of my little mini career in Colombia from the border with Venezuela, because I figured since I couldn't get in there, I'd just go to the edge. And I ended up covering the crisis from the migration angle for these years.
And fascinating. And you've been following a lot of this diaspora crossing through from Venezuela through Colombia and so on. And I mean, I've seen it. I've driven them some of the roads, and we see it now at the traffic lights and on every street corner here in Bogota and the main cities. But give us a little bit of the details about what you've seen. I mean, have you traveled with some of these people?
I have. I did a couple stories that were just kind of set along the highway that many of these Venezuelans use to come into and across Colombia, a highway that goes up, you know, right out of Cucuta, is kind of steamy, short, jungly looking little drier. And you just go straight up into mountains until it gets till you're beyond where there's trees.
Yeah.
Which is like a full day or like a half day drive and a like 5 day walk. So I've been along that road where there's families pulling suitcases and strollers and kind of just set up like they're out for an evening stroll, but backpacking across the continent, actually. Mm. People kind of pile up in towns along the way and sleep a few hundred at a time.
Wow.
But yeah, it's not slowing down.
No. And you, I mean, you join them along the way, talk to them and talk to these people and the situations that they've left and where they're headed. I mean, did you get to speak to people who said, yeah, we've heard that Chile is good or Ecuador is better or Peru's this? Or, I mean, they must have all shared some sort of ideas.
Sure. So just one interesting point on that. I haven't talked with people since this summer when these countries like Chile, Peru, and Ecuador put in visa requirements that make it a lot more hopeless for most people. But otherwise, yeah, I mean, I remember I walked a little ways with this group of like young guys who were probably like 16 to 20, had been set off from their homes on their own to go kind of sink roots somewhere. Mm. And then this one kid, 16 years old, was telling me about how he remembered seeing about Peru on TV, but he never imagined he would go there, much less walking. And they just asked people along the way in highway, along the highway, which way to Peru, which is kind of like, you know, it's like driving through, through France or something and asking which way to Croatia. People don't really know.
No real, grasp of the distance.
No, not really. And they're doing it because everybody else is doing it. Yeah. And so when you know that so many other people already did it, and you know you must be able to do it as well, even though the idea sounds crazy from the outset, walking this huge distance.
That sounds crazy. Which way to Peru? I mean, I could just imagine like a farmer in Norte de Santander going, well, just south. You know, south.
Yeah.
you've done a lot of this. You were there when things got pretty hot on the border with Cúcuta and a lot of the tear gas. I remember some of your tweet updates, your face full of tear gas and so on. And
yep.
I'm sure your folks back home are thrilled at your choice of profession.
I guess they're used to it by now. They're happy they get to read my work, at least, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's no small deal. The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. This is big, big stuff. This is pretty cool stuff. But so tell us, I mean, the most interesting thing recently, I mean, you've done a lot of interesting things, have been these trips you've taken down to what are not these zonas de reintegración, you know, they're not these sort of 16, 17, or however many places around the country that the ex-FARC, you know, the FARC combatants who then turned in their weapons to, you know, sign up for the peace accords that were you know, signed off on in 2016, you went down to different FARC communities, or let's say ex-FARC communities recently, and the pieces have come out in the New Humanitarian. But what's so fascinating about this is the general populace, especially here in Colombia, have no idea that these communities exist.
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty low key. I mean, we're talking about sticks stuck in the mud with some tarps hung up. And yeah, the one that I went to in a place called La Julia was about 150 former combatants. And this, I will point out one thing, because you said ex-FARC, and this was difficult in my writing. We can't say ex-FARC because actually leaders of this are still running with the FARC political party for elections. So they still actually consider themselves FARC. They identify as that.
Mm.
I went to one camp like that, and I went to also one of the government's camps, the most kind of successful, thriving example. Mm. We can talk about that later. But yeah. I would say Colombians do not know that these exist, because to get to the camp that I visited, it was a full day journey down rocky roads in the back of trucks until you are out in the sticks. Mm. And it's actually right on the edge of big national parks. So we're talking about out in the wilderness.
Proper wilderness.
Yeah, and it's the old FARC heartland, you know, Meta and Caquetá. This is like... So
I mean,
this is where these guys grew up.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is their homeland. But I mean, how did you end up saying? I don't even think it's probably phone. Is there even a telephone signal out there? I mean, how did you end up getting an invitation, or do you just rock up?
There is Wi-Fi. You have to pay, and they give you a pin to use Wi-Fi that some guy has, but it's very slow.
Yeah, I bet.
No, I organized this through some think tanks and other sources that I have. I said I wanted to do work on the reintegration, and they said you should go check out these zones where all these guys have just either they never went to the government reintegration camps. Mm. They just went straight from the jungle to do their own deal. Or they were at the government camps and did not get a convincing sense that prosperity lay ahead for this little community. I know many of the government camps have a feeling like this is just kind of puttering and dragging on until the subsidies end, and then no way this is going to work.
Mm.
Anyway, people had a variety of reasons, most of which centered around wanting to get home and be by family that some of them hadn't seen for 20 years when they were in the jungle. And so this is what the group recommended, and I booked passage out there, and it was kind of rough to get to.
Yeah, but you knew the further you go and the more distance it becomes and the more difficult, the greater the story you know is coming because of this isolation, you know. So let's say you shattered your bones, in the back of trucks getting out there and so on. This community, La Julia, you say, this is down in, again, FARC heartlands. But so how many people are in this community?
About, I think 150 people.
Okay, that's small.
Or probably about 100, 170, and maybe about 20 or 30 of those are not ex-combatants. They're family members or other people who come to join.
Okay.
And I will say, at this point, there are about 60 of these communities, according to the same think tank that I went with, which is interesting because at the start of this year, or I think only in March, April of this year, they had that number at 31.
Wow.
So we're seeing more like grouping, possibly people who are fleeing the government camps, but they're setting up these little communities on their own. And so La Julia, like you said, that's actually the nearest town, and town is an overstatement. Yeah. It's like two roads that cross and have like four buildings. And so the camp, which they call the JE Cooperative, I guess after some FARC symbol, is like 30 minutes outside of that town down a rocky road that's cluttered with like horses and cows and stuff.
Yeah.
That's where their little shacks are.
And you say it's basic, sticks and mud, tarps thrown over the top. How are these guys surviving?
Well, so one thing you have to remember is that many of these guys came from 10 or 20 years as nomads in the jungle.
Yeah.
So they're pretty tough. And they have a lot of scars too. It's evident that these guys were in some rough times. One interesting story I heard there, they had a government supplied forest engineer to help them with their farming projects. And she told me that she took a field trip of them to Santander province in Colombia to see their famous cacao, because the guys out there want to grow cacao. And when she took them on this trip, for many it was their first time ever seeing a big city, or pretty much any city, in their 30 or 40 years of life, because they had been in the jungle, like living in tents. So the peace is not what they had expected, because when this peace process was occurring, they were given quite optimistic descriptions, obviously, of what their situation was going to be like, and the government was going to take care of them and provide them little houses, and they were going to move into and help them with these productive projects, and they were going to have nice farms and nice houses with their families and stuff. It didn't quite turn out that way, but I don't think lots of these guys have had better living conditions, perhaps since they left homes as teenagers that were pretty rough. So that's how they get by, and they fish and they hunt wild pig or wild hogs. And they live a lot off government boxes of beans, rice, and lentils as well.
And so you got, I can imagine this. And, as you say, these are hardy people. They've, the frontiers types, they've been in the jungles. They probably grew up in very difficult situations as well. So it's interesting that you should say at least it's a permanent base that they've got as well. They're not nomadic now, but How was their reaction to you? You know, obviously you have to win over some confidence. You know, a gringo journalist walking into their homes, into their lives, and you're saying, "I'm here to tell your story," but do they want it told?
So that was interesting. In both camps that I visited, I went one entire day without doing any interviews.
Yeah.
Just kind of walking and sitting around. And the first camp I visited there outside La Julia, when I first got there, I asked some guys like, "Hey, you know, you think you might be available to do an interview?" And they would tell me, "No." And I just, okay, thanks. So I didn't get to talk with that many. Most didn't want to share anything, but I found that the tactic was just kind of finding people who seemed like they were open to, or maybe were going to be more talkative, and then just like not just being near them for as long as possible time. And then they just start talking to you.
Yeah.
And it comes out. And once the guys and men and women there see another person, talking to the gringo journalist, then they might walk up and then try and tell you their own kind of stuff because they see it's okay now. In any case, both of them I coordinated with the leaders of the camp first.
Yeah.
So introduce me to people.
Yeah.
And that's the only way that made even this difficult communication possible. You know, if I had just walked up on my own, I'd think they would have kicked me out.
Probably.
One interesting story about how they treated me. One guy was obviously trying to scare me the entire time, and he ended up talking to me openly, but he asked me things like if I ever killed anybody before and why not. And I was standing with him as he slaughtered a cow, and as he slaughtered the cow, he told me, "Killing a person and killing an animal, it's the same."
Oh, really?
Yeah. So
a lot for effect than to scare you.
I think he was just messing with me. Okay. I mean, because he kept saying things like this. Most of them I didn't understand because these guys talk pretty like from the country.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was messing with me.
Equally so. You're on their turf. You know, you're out there. There's very little to stop them. You know, just disappearing. But one thing I always find. You know, I was down in Las Colinas in Guaviare some time ago, before we were allowed in and stuff, but I managed to worm my way in and what have you. And even the top guys were kind of, you know, apprehensive about me being there and this, and, you know, we were drinking coffee and then we started drinking some beer and they started relaxing a bit more. And they'd relax a great deal more when they knew I wasn't American. That's the first thing. I was not a CIA operative or anything. And then we ended up talking about the sewer system in London. Because that's what they next had to do, was to put in drains in Las Colinas. And so we were talking a bit about that, and I was like, well, these were all built in the Victorian era. And of course, they couldn't get their heads around that. Did you have any experiences like that, but that they were definitely less open to you because you're from the US?
There's no way for me to tell, but I definitely got that feeling. And I mean, walking around the second camp that I went to that was a little bit more prosperous. I mean, it was full of like, you know, revolutionary symbols and hammer and sickle and Che Guevara and Lenin and guys, fart guys, that just invoked memory, very recent memory of the insurgency and the war. And obviously my country, provided a lot of weapons and guidance and momentum to this war that, of course, in its later years, against these guys who I was there interviewing. So that was interesting, a little uncomfortable. But later we talked about the United States, and I was able to share frank opinions with guys, and I think they, you know, were it was interesting for them to talk with an American. Also, they asked me political stuff and all sorts of things about my country.
This is good, isn't it? It's good when it's a back and forth of ideas and policy and politics. It makes for a much better conversation. And then, of course, your article is going to reflect this too. I mean, you know, there's a proper I don't know, conversation. You know, it's the best way of putting it, not just an interview.
Sure. And what it comes down to is a question of time. Mm. You have to put a lot of time into this.
Yeah.
Like these guys have such a different rhythm of conversation and of life, different pace. Things come out slowly. And yeah, like I said, it starts with like hanging around them silently for a long time. And a thing I noticed when I was with a group and they're all talking, often they talk and then they have periods of silence of 15 or 20 seconds or more where the guys just kind of stand around like, you know? And always I was feeling kind of like, whoa, a little awkward urgency to jump in with a question or something. But they're more communicative if you can kind of adopt this. And like, I just give like 10 seconds after the end of their last statement to think of a question. It was an interesting dynamic that I picked up on there.
This must be something, you know, about so many years, let's say in the jungle, so many years being careful, so many years of watching your words and the conversation and not having the acceleration that perhaps in communication that we have in cities and so on. That's got to be something else, you know, kind of almost harking back to an older time, a time past where you considered conversation and questions and so on.
Yeah, like tribal time.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they reminded me of, was times when I've spoken with indigenous people who've also come from, you know, living in very different conditions than what we're used to. Mm. The life of these guys that I learned about, I hadn't known in such detail. Mm. And, you know, they lived for years with all the same, you know, comrades or whatever. So you run out of things to talk about pretty quick. And they just did marches, you know, day after day, walking. And the rule was no noises after dark. And the rule they told me was, when you join the FARC, you join until the war ends. So everyone joined indefinitely. I had the assumption that people would be like in and out. You know, you'd find some guy who was like, oh, I did 5 years in the FARC. But nope, everyone joined for life.
Wow. And I have to ask, I mean, how did they, you know, are you saying some of these people have left the government camps and some never signed up for the government camps? And then there's family members who've shown up as well. But how are they feeling about the current situation in Colombia? Because obviously they're going to give you some sort of feedback on that.
I think they're feeling discouraged. Mm. The leader of the camp at La Julia talked with me about the FARC leaders, like Santrich and these other guys, Marquez, who dissented and abandoned the peace process and said they're going to take up arms. And this leader at the camp, he said that seemed to him like a violation of their word and a disappointment. And it seemed to him like a fracturing of the process, he said, because everything had been made as like group decisions. Mm. The peace process had been put to everyone. Now, he said, everyone's making unilateral decisions. Some dissident groups have gone some way, another way. Now some leaders have a dissident group. The presidential administration's changed to, of course, a new president who doesn't look at the peace process as his golden child pet project. Mm. So, you know, it's better than war, some said, sometimes. Mm. Most people said that, but there were always caveats. But it's not like they expected. And, you know, of course, during war, like, I didn't really push these topics with these guys a lot, but they stole a lot of food and, you know, made money off of the drug trade and were the armed bosses in charge. And they taxed, you know, they charged a tax of communities that they controlled. So, of course, life is going to be better than when you have to farm. And given that reality, it's pretty, I found it, I don't know, not heartwarming, but like admirable that the dissidents are nearby in this FARC heartland. And all these people had chosen not to join them, not to go back into that, you know, more kind of lucrative armed life.
Mm. That's more or less a lot of the feedback that I've had from people. And of course, the disappointment and the feeling of being very much let down by Sanchich and Marquez, the guys who've gone back, let's say.
There is a
disappointment. There is, especially as you say, these unilateral decisions, group decisions. So you left this place, spent a few days there, and let's just quickly get a little bit of an image. I mean, obviously you are now a guest in their town, in their hamlet, their town, their dwelling, near to La Julia. What is your accommodation like? I mean, I know that people will be fascinated to know what, you know, how did you survive, albeit for the few days there?
Sure. Well, they had a guest hut, which was also dirt floor, green tarp walls, I think perhaps tin roof.
Yeah.
And it had like maybe 12, you know, beds, which were like plywood surfaces there.
Yeah.
And someone brought me a little really damp mattress from somewhere, and they hung a mosquito net over one for me. And then the forest engineer there let me borrow her flashlight because there was no lighting anywhere around there. The toilets were flush with a bucket.
Yep.
And they're pretty crumbly little facility there. People brush their teeth out of also buckets of water. Mm-hmm. They drew the water there from the camp, from a river behind. So I was, okay. I was a little bit, I mean, more like a creek, a stream.
Yeah.
It looked kind of muddy. I didn't drink too much of that water there. Mm. They also had what they called a restaurant, which was one lady from the town who cooked on one like stove hooked up to a propane tank right there.
Yep.
So she fed me the whole time.
Yep.
And other than that, I just spent a lot of time sitting in the shade.
Yeah.
I know what people do.
But it's you know, these are the sort of things that we don't think about. It's just, you know, it's a proper hardship. It's proper going out there. And it's like you said, this, I can imagine this very damp, very, very meager mattress type thing.
And I forgot to mention the catastrophic bug bites.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. They didn't even appear until like 2 days later.
Oh, really?
But stealth? This was like a month and a half ago, and I still have like scars from them. I don't know. There was some nasty jungle bugs out there, and they were like living in my clothes.
But you see, this is it. You are exotic food for these jungle bugs.
I mean, I guess. I must be soft and tender compared with what they normally get.
Definitely. So let's, as we've talked about this one place in La Julia, now tell me about the, sort of, let's say, more successful government camp that you went to.
So the other place is called Agua Bonita.
Mm-hmm.
And the government and the guerrillas built this place.
Mm-hmm.
Little side point here. It's always tough getting out of the FARC guys what the government actually did, since they fought the government in war for 50 years. They often don't admit. So I got to talk to other people.
Yeah.
So turns out they built this together. Like the story I heard was the government laid the floors and put the roofs, and then the FARC guys came and put walls on these buildings. Later they built their own. It has like, you know, dirt, like really muddy roads, like Amazonian muddy. Like your feet sink into them, but lighting and running water.
There you go.
Yeah. And this place has been the beneficiary of many aid programs. So they grow pineapple. A group donated to them like a pineapple processing plant, which is basically a warehouse or a small warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
They have big tanks where they're raising fish. The UN demining agency rents part of it and hires some of the guys to go demine the surrounding area. In general, the place has a much more upbeat feel. And as I said, the walls are covered in murals.
Yeah.
On separate annual occasions, they hired graffiti artists to come out here. And many of these murals have symbols of the war, you know, era, which was not long ago. It just constantly has you reminded that you're here with people who are resettled from conflict, and you know, the hammer and sickle stuff give you some idea of what this insurgency is like.
Mm-hmm.
They get a lot of help and things are looking pretty good. They get a lot of visitors, but they still exist on government subsidies. The government still pays the utilities for the lights and the water. Everybody there, same as in the other camp, by the way, all the ex-combatants get this, get 90% of the minimum salary, and they get this box of food help. That ends next year. And even though this camp is the best example of how the reintegration camps have gone best, with the most promise for being able to earn the money to support themselves way out there, it's tough to see that they're gonna do it really well, you know, within a year.
It's asking a lot, isn't it, to get these, let's say, you know, a community up and running in such a short period of time. It's like sort of building a new town.
Yeah, I mean, the Colombian countryside is very poor.
Yeah.
And you can't just go out there and start from scratch.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, it's interesting because they're just, these guys are re-encountering the same conditions that kind of drove them into conflict, which was slight, you know, kind of hopelessness. And of course, this is the most hopeful of all the camps. But, you know, just the fact that, like, you're way out in the middle of nowhere, it's really hard to get crops to market. This camp, Agua Bonita, the bridge had collapsed on the road to get there, so you had to drive over a riverbed to get in there on a dirt road. So
in rainy season, then it's impossible.
I would imagine. Yeah. They said that the water got out pretty quick from this little creek. It's kind of mountainous, so perhaps there'd be high water as long as it's raining, and then it's gone pretty soon. I do think, though, at nighttime at this camp, I perhaps experienced the heaviest rain of my life, and I've been in hurricanes. It was impressive rain. I could not sleep because of it.
But so I can only imagine that driving rain, the tin roof and stuff. But what's the security situation like in a place like Agua Bonita then? Because, you know, this last week or so, this member of the reintegrated FARC was killed in Mesetas, in a camp. I mean, this is pretty terrifying stuff. But so what, you know, how did you feel the security situation there for the ex-combatants?
So there was a police check or a military checkpoint going there, perhaps a 10 or 20 minute drive outside of the community on the way towards the city. But other than that, I did not see any security presence. I didn't see any guns or anything or any police. Anywhere. So I'm not sure, you know,
I mean, in theory, I think it's the military aren't allowed to be within 2 kilometers of the camp itself. I think that's sort of this legal statistic or something. I think we're pretty sure that there are weapons in the camps, for their own security, I guess these things.
Sure, but, I mean,
It must be. I think I saw some hidden away in Las Colinas. But as you say, I would be a little bit wary because I know that the town nearest to La Colina was very much affiliated with an alternative authority group, let's just say, and they're not happy that this is going on next door to them. So we just sort of worry. And like, as you say, this, it just seems, okay, we've got these subsidies, for want of a better word, running out next year. What's going to happen? I mean, you've got armed people. You've got, it's a worrying situation.
Yeah. Well, recall that the subsidies were originally supposed to end, and the whole reintegration camp program, in August of this year.
Yeah.
And they extended it by a year because there was no way it could have ended this year.
Yeah.
They're totally not ready. So there is also then the possibility that it gets prolonged and prolonged, because what the government sees is this is giving these guys an alternative to going back to the conflict, going back to arms and into the jungle. So it's definitely in the interest of the Duque government, even though, you know, of course, Duque government is going to have to really clench its teeth and close its eyes and hand money to former guerrillas.
Yeah.
But they know that this is like maintaining the stability, and that I mean, if these projects don't work, it's the same story as always in Colombia. These guys are just going to have nothing, and the coca cultivation in this country is about as high as it's ever been. And I mean, if you don't have a livelihood and you can get money doing this, people are going to do it, and you can make a lot better money in that than you can growing potatoes.
Yep, definitely yuca. You know, it's just not even worthwhile planting. But so, I mean, you know, these are two incredible experiences getting out to these camps and seeing with your own eyes. What have you got coming up in the pipeline?
There, I have to admit, is not much coming up in the pipeline. It has been fairly difficult to sell stories lately, and especially as attention has really, shot to some other places in South America. It's tough. You know, the Venezuelan migration is almost the same story as always. It's a little bit hard to sell reports. I am working with one university human rights program from Venezuela to I will write the little stories to accompany the release of their report early next year.
Okay.
Do some from some borders, but otherwise I'm on the market.
This is it. This is a hard graft being a freelancer. It's you know, there's moments of euphoria, obviously when you get reporting jobs and you can report on these things, and then a lot of downtime.
Oh, yeah. Dear. And it takes a lot to keep turning the pedals through it, you know?
Definitely, definitely. Well, you know, I kind of, as I said a couple of weeks ago with Stephen Grattan, kind of moving away from it myself. Just, I don't have the energy to fight with editors and try and negotiate. And
no.
So it gets too much. I've got one kid and one on the way. I've got to be a bit more economically stable, unfortunately.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah. Well, listen, Dylan, I wish you all the best. And if there's anyone out there listening, Dylan Padua is on the market for jobs. Yeah, freelance reporting jobs from here in the region. He's, you know, he's willing, able, and ready to, you know, strap up his boots and his backpack and get out there into the wild. So please, you know, think of these jobbing freelancers. Well, listen, thank you so much for your time and sharing some of these anecdotes and insight into these camps, because for the most part, we have no idea what's going on out there. It's just people existing.
Yep. Yeah. Well, thank you, Richard, for inviting me. It was my honor.
No, it's a real pleasure to have you on, and I wish you all the best in these coming weeks and months, and there will be stories coming up. We just have to find the way of edging out Chile, Ecuador, Bolivia, probably Brazil, probably Venezuela again. So we'll see. Or Nicaragua might boil over. Who knows? You know, it's the way it happens.
Oh, yeah. Stories always come up.
It's always come
There'll
up.
There'll be more.
All right. Well, best of luck and thank you again. And yes, you'll be fine. You know, with these kind of bylines and so on, you'll be absolutely fine. So,
I'm not worried.
Nah. It's been a great pleasure to talk to freelance foreign correspondent Dylan Padua, who's been out and about around Colombia and on the border with Venezuela, reporting humanitarian issues, migration issues, of course, peace issues here, or post-conflict issues, post-accord, better said. This has been episode 298 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I'm Richard McCall. We'll be back next week with episode 299 and a further person to interview who can tell us more about interesting things happening through the lens of Colombia. So thank you for listening and goodbye.